This is Full-Time Catholic Radio for Southeast Michigan, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit.
And good afternoon. Welcome to Cresta in the Afternoon. This is Bryant Shanley, Al's executive producer. Hoping you all had a relaxing and enjoyable weekend as we kick off another week talking about the things that matter most. For as you can tell, this is not Al. Unfortunately, we did have a program lined up today that you may have heard about if you're on the Cresta emailing list and had to switch directions on that last minute and had some technical difficulties. Al is also not feeling great right now. So we are going to be sharing some other discussions we have had previously, and we will be getting back to that other scheduled programming, hopefully later this week. Coming up in this first hour of Cresta in the Afternoon, Dr. Greg Popchak is going to be joining us, talking about the failed experiment of COVID lockdowns. We're now several months into the pandemic, and we've carried out, as a country, two large-scale experiments in public health. First, the initial lockdowns back in March, and since about late April, the slow reopening of the economy. As counterintuitive as it may sound, a lot of the statistics now show that locking down the economy didn't really contain the disease's spread. And so Dr. Greg Popchak will be joining us to talk about that. He also will be talking about this continuing theme of the domestic church and building the domestic church. And so that will be coming up in just a few minutes. And then later on in this hour, Elizabeth Braw has a fantastic story. Today is the feast of Blessed Jerzy Popieluszko, and he is one of many martyrs of the church under Soviet-style communism. And so Elizabeth's not going to be telling Elizabeth Braw will not be telling his story today, but she will be talking about some other parts of these stories in what is called the Cold War Espionage Against the Church. She's the author of a book called God Spies, the Stasi's Cold War Espionage Inside the Church, and that book is available in our online bookstore. And then that's all coming up in this hour of Cresta in the Afternoon, plus a lot more later. First, let's get to the news.
Thanks, Brian. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, October 19th. It's the Feast of Blessed Jerzy Popieluszko. Today's news is brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need at visitingangels.com. Religion is being treated as a second-class part of society. That's what Bishop Nicholas DiMarzio of Brooklyn said Friday, warning that New York's most recent coronavirus measures are not reasonable. Bishop DiMarzio told the Catholic News Agency, too many people today see religion as the problem of society. His comments were made during a day after his diocese argued in court against new state restrictions on religious assembly. Officials in Canada say its U.S. border crossings will remain closed at least until November 21st. Public Safety Minister Bill Blair confirmed the plan today, citing the rate of coronavirus transmissions in both countries. Senators are returning to Washington with two goals for the week. The first is the coronavirus relief package to help the economy, and the second is to confirm Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. The Senate plans to vote on a limited economic aid bill later this week. The Senate Judiciary Committee plans to vote on Barrett Thursday. The Supreme Court will consider two cases on immigration policy and the border wall, one case involving the Trump administration's policy that people seeking asylum in the U.S. remain in Mexico while their cases are pending. The other case is about President Trump's decisions to transfer money from the Defense Department for the construction of the massive border wall on the U.S.-Mexican border. And the district attorney in Kenosha, Wisconsin, says he's not making any decision on charges in Jacob Blake's shooting Friday. Kenosha County District Attorney Michael Gravely on Friday took the unusual step of publicly pushing back against online rumors. Gravely says there will be no decision on charges today, though he's not saying when or if charges may be filed. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Joining me right now, Dr. Gregory Popchak. We are 6 months into the COVID-19 pandemic, and the new U.S. has now carried out two large-scale experiments in public health, first in March and April, and then the lockdown of the economy in the hope to arrest the spread of the virus. The second, since mid-April, was the reopening of the economy. And the results are kind of rolling in, and I think, again, there's a lot of ambiguity here. Greg, good to have you back here. Thanks.
Great to be with you, Al. Thank you.
What is the, as more and more study is done on how we're handling the pandemic, are there any great truths that are being revealed, or are the waters still muddy?
Well, I mean, the waters are muddy, but there are certain things that are beginning to emerge. So, you know, there have been several studies now that that first of all talk about the psychosocial impact of the lockdown. That whether or not lockdowns are a good public health strategy. Research published in the journal Sustainability that was done by professors at UC Davis took a look at how, the stress level that people are experiencing as a result of the lockdowns. Now, this particular study was actually done back in May before, you know, masks were mandatory and closings were prolonged and people are experiencing the significant job losses and the economic fallout from all of this. So you could just imagine that things are much worse even now than they were then. But at just 28 days into lockdown, two-thirds of the people surveyed were reporting moderate to high levels of stress. And that was, you know, these most of the respondents, over 75%, were white, well-educated, and employed at the time. Mm-hmm. The study found that the minorities, people with lower education, people who spoke English as a second language were especially profoundly affected by the stress related to lockdowns. And the recommendations from the study was that whether or not lockdowns are a useful public health strategy, the government needs to do more, or we need more information on how to address the psychosocial impact of this approach, because it is bearing terrible fruit in terms of people's mental and relational health.
You know, it's funny, at the very beginning of this, there wasn't much talk about the emotional consequences of lockdown. It's kind of funny that there was such fear about the virus itself that people were not weighing the consequences, the emotional consequences of this. It took a while for, I think, people to really pick up on it.
No, and we're seeing an increase in suicidality. Yeah. We're seeing an exponential increase in anxiety and depressive disorders. You know, relationship problems are epidemic at this point. And so, you know, again, wherever, you know, whatever the public health policy needs to be to contain the virus, the reality is the approach that we're taking is having serious effects on people's mental health, and it's not being adequately addressed, according to this recent study.
Well, given the fact that people are still limiting their activities considerably, I know that people have come out more than they had back in March and April and June. This also gives opportunity for increased time with family, increased time to rethink what it means to be a domestic church. Mm-hmm. There's an interview that you passed on to me with Bishop Mario Gretsch, new secretary of the Synod of Bishops. I don't know much about him. Tell me a little bit about him and what his, how he's seeing the possibilities of utilizing this pandemic for strengthening the church.
Yeah, he was recently appointed the Secretary General of the Synod of Bishops by Pope Francis. He's a Maltese bishop who was appointed the Bishop of Gozo in Malta by Pope Benedict back in 2005. But in his role as General Secretary for the Synod of Bishops, he's an advisor to Pope Francis, basically, as a sort of a cabinet of sorts that advises the Pope on various issues. And he gave an interview recently where he talked about how the pandemic has given rise in the church to the opportunity to develop a new theology of the domestic church, which is something that you and I have been talking about for quite some time on the program. The need to really appreciate the role that the domestic church, the Catholic family, plays in the role of the life of the church. You know, up until the Second Vatican Council especially, the family was just sort of looked at as a beneficiary of ministry. You know, it was just one more group that we ministered to. And after Vatican II, it was supposed to be that the domestic church would be kind of animated to go out and be a ministry, to bring Christ out to the world. That never actually happened.
Right.
You know, we had language that talked about how we needed to have a different approach toward the domestic church, but literally nothing practical has been done about that. And so even now, we still think of families as just one more demographic that the church needs to serve instead of a ministry that the church needs to animate to go and bring Christ out to the world. And so the pandemic, Bishop Gretsch is saying, has really brought us to the point where we really need to face that fact and address the importance of forming families to be that ministry that they're meant to be.
Mm-hmm. So rather than complaining about not being able to, you know, celebrate funerals in church or having limited weddings or something, it might be more constructive to think about how, under these circumstances, we can best celebrate the Word of God, how to live out a life of service, how to learn, how to discover the gifts of our particular family members.
Mm-hmm.
So,
no, that's right. Well, and that's not to take away the need for that sacramental connection.
Absolutely.
He makes that point, you know, that that the domestic church is dependent upon the Eucharist, like everything else is. Right?
Sure.
You know, so it all flows through that Eucharistic grace. But having even had one encounter of that Eucharistic grace, it transforms us, it changes us, it makes us a new creation. And so what does that mean on the street? You know, and that's a question we've not done a good job really answering. And so Bishop Brecht is saying there really needs to be this renewed focus on the ministry of domestic church life. How do we experience Christ in our homes in more meaningful ways? And how do families more effectively bring Christ to the world in more meaningful ways? And really, you know, our ecclesiology, the theology of church, has always been that the parish exists to support the ministry of the domestic church. Unfortunately, practically speaking, pastoral practice has been exactly the opposite. Our experience has been, how does the family support the parish?
Right.
And so all of our energy becomes directed internally,
yeah,
as opposed,
mm-hmm,
to externally to the world where we can evangelize. We just become kind of self-referential in that way, in the approach that we've been taking. So Bishop Brecht is recognizing that there needs to be more of that outward focus, where the church, the institutional church, supports the domestic church, who brings the world to Christ through, mm-hmm, through its love.
There's a part of this is, it's funny, it's kind of ironic, because we have such a high view of the Eucharist. You know, it's an encounter with Christ Himself, body, blood, soul, and divinity, and so that sacramental action takes place usually in a parish setting,
mm-hmm,
and we tend to think of our homes as somehow the place where that doesn't happen. So when we're deprived of the full sacramental action within the parish church, we think that what's happening at home is somehow second rate.
Mm-hmm.
When in fact, the sacramental action of the church is intended to equip us to take that grace that we received in the sacrament back in our homes and then out to the world.
Right. Well, and, you know, so Lisa and I, as a result of hosting the Symposium on Catholic Family Life and Spirituality back in 2019 at the University of Notre Dame, we've been working with the USCCB's Secretariat for Family Life and the National Association of Catholic Family Life Ministers to promote something we're calling the Liturgy of Domestic Church Life,
right,
which is all about, you know, doing exactly what you were describing. And when we presented this to a group of bishops back in January before the lockdown, one of the bishops said that this Liturgy of Domestic Church Life, he sees it as the, quote, mystical vehicle that allows Eucharistic grace to be transported through the family into the world.
Yeah.
And that's the way it's supposed to be.
Beautiful.
Right? It's not that we receive the Eucharist and boom, we're done.
Right. Right.
It's, you know, we go to the ecclesial vending machine, take out Jesus, and boom. You know, that sounds sacrilegious. It's because it is. You know, it's not the way it's supposed to be.
Right. Right.
You know, we receive that sacramental grace to be able to take it out into the world. And this idea of the domestic church and this liturgy of domestic church life is that mystical vehicle that allows us to carry Eucharistic grace into our homes and then out into the world and transform the world through that experience of Christ's love.
So this, have you gotten any resistance to this idea?
Honestly, no.
Yeah.
And I mean,
yeah, normally you can count on it.
I know, exactly.
Right.
You know, and I've been shocked. I mean, it's been universally excited. People who've heard it have been universally excited and energized by it. Like I said, we presented it to a group of 12 bishops last January before the lockdown, who were incredibly thrilled by it. In fact, one bishop has completely reorganized his entire family life office around it. The Diocese of Orlando has created an entire program around it in the last 8 months. The USCCB, we've been talking with them about doing some things to, they're rolling out the pastoral plan for for the rollout on Amoris Laetitia, and they're talking with us about integrating some of the elements of this Liturgy of Domestic Church Life in that pastoral plan and as a follow-up to it. We've gotten such tremendous support. All the people who participated in the National Association of Catholic Family Life Ministry summit that we did online have been looking at ways to implement it in their diocese. There's definitely movement happening. The Holy Spirit is doing something new here, and it's very exciting to see the response that we're getting. And, you know, to see that the people in the higher levels of the church are asking these really important questions.
Mm. You know, this is, is in this interview with Bishop Mario Grech, there's a statement of Pope Francis, which is quoted. Let me see if I can quickly locate it here. The family, let's see, the point of it is that the domestic church has the duty to help domesticate the world. I mean, that's the was the basic thought of it, that the love and intimacy that marks family life is meant to help make the world a greater a greater sense of family.
God has entrusted the family not to the responsibility for intimacy as an end in itself, but at the exciting project of making the world domestic.
Yes, yes. Yeah. That's a beautiful statement.
Well, it is, and I think that the point we try to make in the Liturgy of Domestic Church Life model that we talk about is that we have to take our cue as families for learning how to love as the church teaches us to love, as God wants us to love, not as the world teaches us to love. And that's how we do our ministry, that ministry of learning how to love as God wants us to and carrying that out to the world.
Amen. Greg, thanks so much. How do people stay in touch with you?
CatholicCounselors.com.
Very good. We'll talk again.
God bless, Al.
Dr. Gregory Popcheck, CatholicCounselors.com.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. St. John Paul II stated that for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love, and the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation. So we know we're called, but how do we do it? St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
This program is brought to you in part by the support of MVP Realty Associates, helping people find homes in the town of Ave Maria, Florida. The town of Ave Maria has a water park, golf courses, restaurants, medical and retail stores, and is located 20 minutes from Naples. New construction and resale homes are available. More information about the town of Ave Maria and the vision of Domino's Pizza founder Tom Monahan is available from Greg Musumano at 239-825-6958.
It's Jeep Adventure Days at Pinckney Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram. Come shop their over 10 acres of loaded vehicles marked down to the lowest prices of the year. If you're in the market for a new vehicle and would love to be treated with dignity and respect, look no further. Pinckney Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram has payments as low as $199 per month on new 2020 Jeep Compasses, or $239 a month on 2020 Jeep Gladiators. Or get behind the wheel of a new 2020 Jeep Wrangler for as low as $212 a month. Come in and experience the difference during Jeep Adventure Days. Shop online at PinckneyChrysler.com.
Can there be peace between creation and evolution? What does the purposeful order of the universe tell us about its origin? Hi, this is Peggy Stanton. Join Dr. Daniel Keebler and me for a fascinating discussion of science and faith this Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams. Contemplate the universe with me.
You do not know the work of God, who is working in everything.
Every cell of your body contains a helix strand of DNA made from 3 billion molecules. But only 1.5% of those 3 billion are the genes used to produce the proteins that determine your biological traits. Initially, this caused scientists to label the remaining 2.9 billion junk DNA. But today, scientists are discovering it's probably not junk at all, but critical to our lives and the well-being of later generations. But when asked exactly what good are those billions of mysterious molecules, they really have no idea. But God knows, and one day you will too. At AveMariaRadio.net, under Resources, explore the universe with me. I'm Dr. Stan Williams.
Be a blessing to your neighbors in need through your gift to Catholic Charities of Southeast Michigan. Together we can change the faces of despair, loneliness, hunger, and addiction, one blessing at a time. As the charitable arm for the corporal works of mercy throughout the Archdiocese of Detroit, Catholic Charities exists to provide the services that make a difference in the lives of over 20,000 people each and every year in Southeast Michigan. So how would you like to bless your neighbor today? Visit ccsem.org/donate to choose your involvement.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo.
Life, religious freedom, and health care are at stake in this year's election. Do you have the right tools to confidently cast a vote that's informed by your Catholic faith? Join the Christ Medicus Foundation, CMF Curo, Divine Mercy University, and the Catholic Medical Association October 20th for Decision 2020, the informed Catholic voter. This 90-minute virtual event uses the lens of faith to address the important issues. Register for this free event at CatholicHealthcareConference.com.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. When we talk about the collapse of Soviet-style communism, we often emphasize John Paul II's pilgrimages back to his native Poland, the rise of the trade union Solidarity, Lech Walesa, the martyr priest, Father Jerzy Papiuszko. But there are so many remarkable stories of faithful Christians behind the Iron Curtain in other countries as well. East Germany, for instance. East Germany came into existence in October of 1949, and the communists understood from the beginning that the country's churches were going to be resistant to the communist program, because, of course, the Christian worldview is at odds with an atheistic worldview. And so they went through great efforts, that is, the communist government, to develop the Stasi, the Ministry for State Security, created that in 1950, and they had a specific department to keep an eye on the country's churches and their members. With me right now to tell this story in a way that I've never heard of it before is Elizabeth Frost. She is the author of God Spies, the Stasi's Cold War Espionage Committee Inside the Church. She runs the Modern Deterrence Project at RUSI, a London-based defense and security think tank. She was previously a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor and Newsweek and contributes to the Wall Street Journal, the London Times, Foreign Policy, and the Financial Times, focusing on European security. Elizabeth, good to have you with me. Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Now, this you managed to actually build your story by your contact through with this one fellow, Weigand. Is that right?
That's right. He was, so Joachim Wiegand is his
Wiegand.
Name.
Wiegand, yes, very good.
He has never been interviewed for a book before, but miraculously he agreed to speak with me, I think because I've written a lot about East Germany in the past and he felt comfortable with me. And so he has never been interviewed for a book, but he agreed to be interviewed by me and we spent many, many hours together. And the reason he's so important is that he was the director of this department, church department, the official name was Department 20/4 of the Stasi for the last 10 years of East Germany's existence, and he had risen through the ranks as an officer within that department. So if there's anybody who knows what East Germany did to infiltrate its churches, it's Joachim Wiegand, and so he is the centerpiece of this book.
And you also focus on four particular pastor agents. How do they get pastors to become agents for the communist government there?
Well, that's a very good question. That's a question that the Stasi asked itself in its infancy, because it's one thing to be in an atheist government and say, oh, we need to minimize the power of the churches. Well, how do you do that? You can do it like the Soviets did by putting lots of people in prison, but the East Germans didn't want to do that. Or in the early years, they tried to sort of brutal approach, but it didn't really work. And you look bad internationally if you put lots of Christians in prison. So they tried this very cunning, tried and succeeded with this very cunning strategy, which was to recruit pastors at any level, so from lowly theology students up to bishops, to report for them. And for them, the great thing, for the Stasi, the great thing was that many pastors agreed to do it. Of course, for us outsiders, it's really depressing to know that so many pastors and theology professors and high-ranking pastors and bishops agreed to essentially spy on their fellow human beings.
Mm. What was the motivation behind Vegan's involvement? I mean, had he been politically active, and he actually was an ideologue, and enjoying the prospect of a communist future?
Not at all. He was an ordinary teenager during World War II, and like many, many, many Germans of that age, he lost his father. So he grew up the single son of a widowed mother. And he, when the war ended, was a teenager and worked as a farmer. And then in the early 50s, when the Stasi had been created and they started recruiting officers, he was recruited. And I won't tell you the recruitment pitch now, but it was very cunning. The way the Stasi recruited officers, because it was not like, you have to be a communist. It was more subtle than that. You know, do you want to help build a peaceful society? That sort of thing.
Right.
And it was a steady job, and it was, helping protect a society that said it wanted peace. Well, who is against peace? I don't know anybody.
Right.
and Vegan, that's what he felt he did all along, starting with his training as an officer cadet, and then through his career within the Stasi, he felt he worked for peace, and he just felt sometimes you have to use maybe unpalatable means to reach that goal.
But that's how he understood it then. He saw this as a fundamentally constructive task.
That's right. I mean, so the challenge, the fundamental challenge that the East German government faced was that, as you said in your introduction, it wanted to be an atheist country, but yet the country had all these Christians, especially Lutherans, because of course this is where Luther was born and lived.
Right.
In the former East Germany. And those Christians had not only did they have a different worldview, they also had international contact, and that was a huge challenge for the government. How do you make sure that your Christians, the government was fine letting them attend church services, but they shouldn't do anything else, and they especially shouldn't voice any opposition against the government, but yet they were so powerful, and they had all these international contacts. They had people who sort of looked in from the outside, Americans and others, to sort of make sure they were okay. These people, even though they may have not been very prominent within East German society, had this importance simply because they were so well connected abroad. And that made it even more challenging for the Stasi to sort of keep them quiet. Because if anything were to happen to them, their contacts abroad, even if, let's say American A didn't know East German Christian X, he or she would hear that such person had been maybe put in jail or lost his job and so forth. So it was a fundamental challenge for the Stasi, which is why these pastor agents were so important. These pastor agents who told the church bureau everything they came across, and then the church bureau could act on it. And of course, the fundamental problem they had there was, well, how do you act on all this discontent that your pastors keep reporting about?
Yeah.
You'd have to completely change society in order for that discontent to go away.
So I'm trying to think. So did these pastors sign on the dotted line somewhere, or was this more subtle?
Oh, yeah, they did, yes. So when you hear about, when people hear about staff informants, in some cases, the informants didn't even know, and there were hundreds of thousands of them, they didn't even know that they had been sort of logged in the Stasi's register. But with these pastor agents, many of them were very active, and they had regular meetings undercover, following, you know, these sort of rules of watching, so that making sure that you're not being watched when you enter the safe house and so forth. That was all part of it, and they had regular meetings with their handlers, and of course they expected favors in return from the Stasi, in return for their services to the Stasi. It was very, very not just sophisticated, but very intense cooperation in many cases. And you mentioned, I highlighted in the book four pastors. They, all four of them, had very extensive cooperation over many years with the Stasi.
Wow. And how did they benefit from it personally?
Well, that's the thing, that the Stasi, including Joachim Wiegand, they were very perceptive in figuring out what makes somebody tick.
Mm.
So, and based on that, they were able to offer that to that person. And it's actually quite depressing when you realize that some people sell themselves very cheaply. And so with these pastors, it's not like they got enormous monetary rewards. It wouldn't even have been possible. But it, what they, the sort of very small amounts of money and rewards that they got in return, that they sort of sold their soul for, that's quite depressing. Then, of course, there were pastors who genuinely felt that they were helping East Germany survive,
right,
by doing this, and they felt that actually the church was just sort of a remnant from the expansionist, Nazi Germany, and they wanted to do everything to make sure that Germany never became expansionist again. Then there were others, and one of the pastors that is that are featured, a certain Gerd Bambalski was his name. He, and this would be of interest in particular to your listeners in America, he infiltrated the Bible smuggling organizations.
Really?
That were so active, especially in the 70s and 80s, in bringing smuggling, really, Christian literature and other books and printing presses to the Soviet Union and other countries behind the Iron Curtain. He infiltrated those groups.
And he tried to disrupt the flow of Bibles then into East Germany?
He did. He not just tried, he succeeded in doing so.
Wow. Tell me how.
I won't give too much away, but he was a very talented undercover operator. He works for the Stasi all along while doing this, and he started. If you think of successful spies, they make contacts, and those contacts like this new acquaintance, and they recommend him to others, and that's how he worked. And so he essentially made himself extremely useful in these circles, because there weren't really a lot of people who were able to smuggle books into the Soviet Union and other East Bloc countries in large quantities. And that's what he was able to do. And how, I think, it also, a little bit, he managed to exploit people's gullibility, because everybody wants to track the pastor, right?
Right, right.
And they did.
Well, Elizabeth, hold it there. We'll come back on the other side of the break and continue conversation. My guest, Elizabeth Braw, she is the author of God Spies.
The Archdiocese of Detroit Cemeteries would like to invite you to several events. On Sunday, November 1st, between the hours of 2 and 6 p.m., we are hosting our first Day of the Dead celebration at Our Lady of Hope Cemetery in Brownstown. Among the events will be mariachi bands, costume contests, and a candlelight rosary. On All Souls Day, Holy Sepulchre Cemetery in Southfield will host our annual All Souls Day Mass with Bishop Cepeda, beginning at 9 a.m. Our Lady of Hope Cemetery will also host an All Souls Day Mass with Bishop Battersby presiding at 11 a.m. And finally, on Saturday, November the 7th, between the hours of 5:30 and 8:30, both Holy Sepulchre and Our Lady of Hope Cemeteries will host our annual Vigil Light drive-through. Families can decorate luminaria bags in honor of their loved ones to help illuminate the main drive at each location. For more information, please call 313-879-3731. That's 313-879-3731.
Seeking direction after the loss of a loved one or planning for your future? Let Sarah Meinhart be your legal compass. Sarah Meinhart PLLC is a compassionate and professional boutique law firm providing customized legal services with trust and probate administration, estate planning, and probate court. Take a step toward peace of mind by visiting sarahmeinhartlaw.com or contacting Sarah by email at meinhart@sarahmeinhartlaw.com.
There is a silent suffering happening all around us. Families don't know where they will get their next meal. Diseases go untreated. Jesus tells us that following him means that when we see someone who is hungry, we feed them. When we see someone who is sick, we care for them. At Hope Clinic, you can be salt and light in the world. Last year, your support met over 60,000 requests for help. Visit thehopeclinic.org to make lives better in Jesus' name.
How does the baby move in your tummy?
How does the baby eat?
Can the baby hear me?
How did the baby get in there?
Wow, a pregnancy can sure generate a lot of questions. But what's important is that a baby is a baby, inside and out of the womb. Not just after birth, but 9 months before. At conception.
That's right. Every baby is a miracle. Hello, my name is Marianne Kuharski. I'm the director of Pro-Life Across America. If you know someone who is pregnant or in need of alternatives or assistance or would like to support the work of Pro-Life Across America, please visit our website at prolifeacrossamerica.org or better yet, simply dial #250 on your cell phone and say the keyword pro-life. Pro-Life Across America is non-political and totally educational.
A baby's heart is beating 18 days from conception.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a non-profit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
Please join Archbishop Alan Vigneron and the Southeast Michigan business community in celebrating the 27th annual Mass for Commerce. In person and live streaming from St. Anne's Basilica in Detroit on Wednesday, October 21st at 8 a.m. A panel discussion on incorporating faith into daily business will be available. For more information, please visit massforcommerce.org. That's massforcommerce.org. Please join them on the 21st.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Looking over the East German Stasi's Cold War espionage campaign inside the church in East Germany, my guess, Elizabeth Brau is the author of God's Spies. And last segment we closed by taking a look at the way the Bible smuggling operations were disrupted by these pastor agents in East Germany. There's a quote of Wiegand, who heads up the church department, the Stasi church department, where they're in, monitoring what's going on in the various churches. And he says something to the effect of, look, we'll let them pray, we'll let them go to church, but we won't let them do politics. Of course, the irony is that the church prayer movement in East Germany actually ended up having much soft political power, didn't it?
That's exactly right. And that's something that the Stasi, including Wiegand, was aware that it had the potential to do. So the thing about Lutheran churches in Germany and in East Germany in particular is that they have this sort of activist tradition that Lutheran churches and other churches elsewhere don't really have. It's almost like if you think about the liberation theology in Latin America, that church is not just church, it's sort of a political movement. Mm-hmm. Well, that's exactly what the Stasi wanted to avoid.
Right.
So, yes, Wiegand's philosophy was let them sing, let them pray, but they shouldn't do politics. And so, but how do you prevent that from happening, especially because in East Germany, churches were really the only semi-free space in society. It was the only place where people could gather and express some sort of opposition. And as a result, you had all these groups that I think in a free society would not have gathered in churches. So you had democracy groups, you had environmental protection groups, with, you know, people caring about the environment. Those sort of groups don't really have to meet in churches, but in East Germany, that's where they met because it was only semi-free space. And then, that was already the cost of posed a headache to the Stasi. Well, you can't really close down groups that want to protect lakes and rivers. I mean, you would look ridiculous internationally. So
they couldn't really
do anything about that. But then in the late 80s, churches got even more organized and started these peace prayers, and that was an enormous headache for the Stasi. You can't really tell churches that they can't host peace prayer meetings, you know, especially when your country proclaims
right.
promoting peace. So that was a huge dilemma. And as the Stasi predicted, these peace prayer meetings grew in number, they grew in size, and they started taking place every Monday across the country. And that was really the beginning of the end of East Germany, because once those, the peace prayer meetings started started turning into protests after the peace prayer meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So the prayers would end, and then the people would sort of gather outside and shout a few words about democracy. And then it turned into protests. And that's really when it became obvious that East Germany couldn't survive, because there were so many of these peace prayer meetings and the protests were so large. And people really didn't want to live in East Germany. That was the message.
Right.
Or East Germany would have to reform itself so fundamentally. So without churches, it stands to reason, without churches, East Germany would not have fallen so quickly. And that's why that Stasi's church department was so incredibly important, because even though it failed in the end, it did manage for many years to keep Christian activism and opposition really quite limited.
So it did. So it was able to. In other words, the Berlin Wall would have fallen sooner if the Stasi hadn't been so effective.
It wouldn't have fallen without Gorbachev. I think Gorbachev and you mentioned Pope John Paul II.
Yeah.
Those are two so pillars of the 80s, without whom we would not have seen the end of the East Bloc when it did happen. But I think it's accurate to say that without the Stasi being so effective in infiltrating churches, those protests would have grown much larger, much sooner.
I see. Okay. How, when Wiegand looks back upon his work as head of the Stasi Church Department, and he sees, does he see that he was on the wrong side of history, or does he see that he was doing his job at a particular time, and you know, world events changed?
Well, I think he sees himself as having served a country just like you and I would serve our countries.
Okay.
And it just happened to be a country that no longer exists. And he thinks he did his best to serve that country, but he also says in the end it was pointless because that country had ambitions of surviving for a very, very long time. In the end, it only survived for 40 years. But he doesn't feel guilty. And I must say, having worked so closely with this now for a long time, I can see why he doesn't feel guilty. I think the people who really should be feeling guilty are the pastors who essentially sold out their friends and acquaintances and worked undercover. The officers themselves didn't work undercover. It was they drew their paycheck from the Stasi. That was their job.
That's right.
But the pastors who agreed to surreptitiously, deviously betray their friends, I think they are the real villains, if you will, of this story. And it's interesting how few of them have come forward. Almost none have come forward without having first been unmasked. In other words, they don't even feel the inner need to say, I did it.
Mm.
Please forgive me. They'd rather just live with the secret.
Do you know roughly how many pastors were agents for the Stasi?
So in total, at any given time, around 180,000 people worked as agents for the Stasi. Now, it's unclear how many of them were pastors. And the reason it's unclear is that the Stasi managed to shred most of its file in those frantic final days.
I see.
Vigan says he had about 100 good people, as he expresses it. So, but it's safe to say there was several hundred over the years. Then some were extremely active and worked for decades with the Stasi. Some may just have given occasional pieces of information.
Do you know if the pastors that you refer to in the book, do you know if they retained any form of Christian faith through this whole thing, or did they become cynics?
That is a very good question. So, from what I can tell, the pastors who actively worked with the Stasi became cynical if they were not already cynical, and they did it to gain personal advantages. Now, the one of them I've interviewed in depth for this book, he is convinced that by working for the Stasi, by spying for the Stasi, he helped a good cause, which was anti-militarism in Germany, and he desperately wanted East Germany to survive because he felt it was the better Germany. And he, this is quite charming, actually. So he has been defrocked, one of very few pastors who have been defrocked. He has been defrocked, and he lives in his parents' house in his home village, and there is a church next door. And he writes the church letter, church newsletter for that church. I think that's quite touching. He still wants to make a contribution. He feels it would be inappropriate for him to do anything other than the newsletter, but he does that.
Interesting. I would have thought the Stasi would want to focus in on new pastors. So did they have an active program with the seminaries?
They did, and the reason that they had, that they were so interested in seminaries is that, so there were two different ways of becoming a pastor in East Germany. You could go, to university and do your theological training there, but universities were, of course, part of the government, so, those were sort of pretty much middle of the road, people who went there. And then, churches maintained their own seminaries, and that's where, let's say, opposition-minded types gathered, and that's why the Stasi really had to keep a close eye on those seminaries. And it did recruit at those seminaries, of course, as well. It recruited both students and professors very cunningly, because it knew that the agents it needed was not people who were already convinced communists. It needed people who maintained contacts to the West, to sort of like the West, because they would be able to deliver information on the sort of people that the Stasi was interested in.
How dominant was the Lutheran Church in East Germany?
It was and remains the largest church, even though it's paradoxically it's smaller today than it was during East German times. The Lutheran Church was the predominant church in East Germany. Then there was, of course, a Catholic Church as well.
Yeah.
The Catholics were easier in a sense for the Stasi, simply because they were not as opposition-minded, they were not as activist, they really were liturgically focused.
I see.
But the Stasi spied on them as well. Within the church department, there were different bureaus that focused on the different denominations.
So were priests easier to recruit than, say, Lutheran pastors?
No, they were not. And I think it's because there was... it was easier to recruit Lutheran pastors, I would say, simply because there was more interaction. They were more active.
Yeah, so, okay.
Yeah, you have to sort of think of this from a Stasi perspective. How do you even meet a pastor? What do you talk about?
Right.
And if, as was the case with Lutheran pastors, if you can talk about politics and so forth, and you can gauge that pastor's leanings, how he feels about where East Germany is going, whereas... Catholic priests were really much more liturgically focused, were not really active in politics and didn't even express opinions about it. And that's a little bit different from Poland, which you mentioned in your introduction,
yeah,
where the Catholic Church was really much more politically active.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's very interesting. I mean, Northern Germany has always been more strongly Protestant than Southern Germany, too, so... Elizabeth, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yes, I hope we can talk again in the future. This is a fascinating story, and I've never heard it told before. So thank you.
Thank you.
It's called God Spies, the Stasi's Cold War Espionage Campaign Inside the Church.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo. Your search for affordable health care stops here. Since 2014, CMF Curo has provided Catholics with affordable health care sharing that goes beyond insurance. With programs that cost less than many COBRA and ACA-sponsored plans, CMF Curo is a Catholic health sharing experience that enables you to live fully alive while saving money. Call 1-833-GET-CURO to find affordable Catholic health care now. That's 1-833-GET-CURO.
My dad, sharp as a tack, but getting him out for a dentist trip got harder every year. When he moved to the senior residence where he lives now, Dr. Mansour's portable dental service was a godsend. Dr. Mansour comes to wherever the homebound patient may be, whether in a nursing facility or the comfort of home. All the services you'd expect in a dentist office brought straight to the patient's door. Call 586-873-5567. That's 586-873-5567 or portabledentalservices.com.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at AveMariaRadio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
There's a lot of uncertainty in the world right now. Companies have temporarily stopped hiring. Sporting events are held without fans. Even your friends are being told to keep their social distance from you. However, at Ave Maria University, we ask you to consider advancing while the world around you recedes. Gaining an online master's degree in business administration or theology can propel you forward, distinguishing you from the competition when companies again start hiring. Apply now at avemaria.edu.
Thank you so much for joining us over this first hour of Cresta in the Afternoon. As we were discussing many things in that hour, if you'd like to learn more about Elizabeth Sprowl's book, God's Spies, the Stasi's Cold War Espionage Campaign Inside the Church, that is available in our online bookstore or in our Cresta guest archives. Also, in this hour, we of course talked to Dr. Greg Popchuk about some of the data is showing on the COVID pandemic, as well as this continuing theme of building the domestic church. If you are on Facebook, I would highly encourage you to join Greg's new group that he's been going. He's been running this group now for a few months. It's called Catholic Households on Mission. If you go to Facebook and search Catholic HOM, you can find it very easily. It's actually I'd say worth joining Facebook just to join that group. There's a lot of stuff on social media that's very counterproductive to our lives as Christians, but this is absolutely outstanding. You just need to request to join the group, and he'll let you in, and you can join in with other Catholics who are talking about how their families are building the domestic church, building the strength in their families, even during these very trying times. Coming up in the next hour of Cresta in the Afternoon, as I mentioned earlier, if you realize this is not Al talking right now, we had planned some great stuff for today that we unfortunately had to push back to later in the week, and so we will be getting to that later. But in this next hour, a great testimony story around Dr. Dave Anders, who you hear frequently on Ave Maria Radio and EWTN, will be saying how the Catholic Church saved his marriage. Stay tuned.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.